Blog Talk Radio.
Take my love, take my land, take me where I cannot stand. I don't care, I'm still free. You can't take the sky from me. Take me out to the black. Tell them I ain't coming back. Burn the land and boil the sea. You can't take the sky from me. There's no place I can be since I found serenity. You can't take the sky from me.
Tread on me. Good evening. You are live with Tex and Rex. Irreverent, relevant, and radioactive conservatism with a bite. I'm your host, Rex, broadcasting to you from the Imperial City.
And this is Tex, broadcasting from somewhere deep in the heart of Texas. So we've got another show lined up this weekend. Lots of things going on out there, but most notably some things that are sort of near and dear to the conservative and, I believe, libertarian cause. So, Rex, what is on the agenda for tonight?
Well, the agenda for tonight is to really have an interesting conversation about something that most of us fail to understand. The NRA had a big meeting down your way in Houston this weekend, some great speeches. Talking about, you know, the right to bear arms, which is, for the most part, for libertarians and conservatives, a relatively easy question. You know, we have the right to bear arms, period, end of story. The real confusion stems in from that first part of the amendment. And, you know, the founding fathers were geniuses. They were pithy. They were succinct. They meant what they said, and they said what they meant. And then over 200 and some years, we've found permutations and penumbras and all sorts of mental gymnastics to try to make something where something wasn't, or vice versa. So, you know,
the penumbra of the permutation.
Exactly. You know, so the interesting thing is, you know, what is liberty and what is security? And are these two things in conflict? And for the most part, you know, we tend to think of it in a dialectic where you either have liberty or security, or you trade one or the other or some degree thereof for both. But, you know, I think that from a true American conservative perspective, liberty itself is security. The most free and secure society is the one that has the most liberty and the people share in the responsibility for security. So over the years, we've kind of been left with this situation, and, you know, as Spinoza said, nature abhors a vacuum, where some people don't want the responsibility of liberty, the security. So they tend to give that up, and, you know, like anything else, if you create a vacuum of security, someone will fill the vacuum. And based on what we saw in Boston a couple of weeks ago, and based on Rand Paul's 13-hour filibuster, it seems that the state, specifically the federal state, wants to fill that vacuum for you to provide you security. But that in itself is a threat to liberty. So I don't know. Did you catch any of the NRA stuff down there, Tex?
Yes, I did. I caught a lot of it on SiriusXM as I was driving. So I heard quite a bit of it. I did not hear the whole thing. I mean, it went on for quite a while. Certainly sounded interesting. I think a lot of people are fired up about this issue, and I think it's something that the people are winning in terms of limiting Washington, D.C.'s ability to limit the right to keep and bear arms, which shall not be infringed under the Constitution. I think the anti-gun lobby, the restrictionists, have reached their Waterloo, and they don't understand why. They thought they'd seized on the perfect crisis, never let a good crisis go to waste. And they don't understand why people still want to maintain their constitutional rights, even in the face of a horrible tragedy that should never have happened in the first place. But the problem is the government doesn't have a solution to that because chaos reigns. You will always have these types of problems. You'll have them in a state-run system. You'll have them in a situation where the people are free. And the best thing to do is have the people be free rather than have the state control everything. And so what they want to do is start confiscating, start taking away the ability of people to keep and bear arms because their idea is that we can protect you from this. But they can't.
Yeah.
They never can.
No.
It's an impossibility. But they're selling you this false sense of security. Don't worry. We'll take away your ability to defend yourself. We'll take away all of your rights that were granted to you under the Constitution, which came from your creator. And we will protect you because you don't know what you're doing. And we'll protect
right.
you from those mean, evil people. We being
oh.
people, mean, evil people, that being sort of the institution of government, the historical institution of government, which if you look back throughout history, is probably one of the main things that you want to protect yourself against. It has a very bad track record in managing or self-policing itself. I think that people, free people, have a better track record policing themselves than an unaccountable government.
Yeah, I think you nailed it right there. And I think the funny thing is that people are kind of, you know, they're kind of squishy about this, you know, because guns are scary and you know we want to be totally protected and safe and risk averse. I'm like, you know, life is risk. Business is real. If you want free markets, you know, you got to risk capital. If you want liberty, you've got to risk danger. You know, the government is not there to protect you from yourself or from the inherent risks of life. It is there to guarantee rights you already have from being molested by others. And guarantee means that there is a process by which to prosecute those who violate those rights as opposed to prevent them from violating them in the first place because, as Tex said, even in the most totalitarian state, there will still be a criminal element. They will still take advantage of people. And in the most free state, you'll still have people who want to take advantage of other people. That's just life. So quit being squishy. Speaking of squishy, Tex, there's somebody who called out some people for being squishy down your way in Houston. This is 3.5 minutes of an excellent speech. You should check out the whole thing. Senator Ted Cruz at the NRA convention. And on the other side of this, we've got Mr. David Callahan, president of Revitalize the Second Amendment, will be joining us to have a conversation about what does the Second Amendment actually mean, and did the Founding Fathers devise a system by which we would provide our own security without leading to a police state? So here's Ted Cruz.
They talk about violent crime, and yet their proposal didn't have one penny for prosecuting felons or fugitives or for prosecuting gun crime. The target of their legislation is not violent criminals. The target of their legislation is law-abiding citizens. That doesn't make any sense. Third and final thing I want to say to you, Dave, is in America, the people have the power. A month ago, you had the president holding, it seemed, press conference after press conference after press conference, and his package of legislation that would have undermined the Second Amendment in Washington look like an unstoppable freight train. Well, I'll tell you, I was proud to join with my friends, Senator Rand Paul and Senator Mike Lee, in writing a short and simple letter to Harry Reid that said, we will filibuster any legislation that undermines the Bill of Rights or the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms. What happened next was truly amazing. What happened next is each and every one of you, millions of Americans, began speaking out.
We're taking a quick break here on NRA Leadership Forum and be right back here on SiriusXM Patriot.
Gun owners
Stay there,
of
please.
America is wonderful. The Second Amendment groups are wonderful, but every one of them is just a vehicle for you, for the people. And what happened in this battle is millions of men and women across this country got on the phone, got on the internet, got on Facebook, got on Twitter, spoke out and said, leave our Constitution alone. I have to tell you, it is particularly fun standing up here in front of a ginormous American flag. It's the closest a lawyer from Houston can ever come to feeling like General George Patton. But I will say this, I am looking at an army. And the voice of each of you is how we win. And because each of you spoke out and because millions of Americans spoke out 2 weeks ago when the proposals came to a vote, every vote that would have undermined the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms was voted down.
How's that? Pretty powerful, right?
Excellent. Yeah, I thought he gave a really good speech. I thought it was very powerful. You know, he's talking about the founding documents and the fact that people aren't going to put up with this anymore.
Yeah, I like the part where he talked about the fact that we're winning, and he talked about having an army. Now, I don't know if that's precisely the right term to use because, you know, technically – kind of a volunteer force of patriotic citizens wouldn't quite be called an army, but it might be called a militia. And so speaking of militias, we're joined by David Callahan, Revitalizing the Second Amendment, which speaks specifically about the militia. David, you're live with Tex and Rex. Good evening.
Good evening, gentlemen. Hi, Tex and Rex. It's a pleasure to be with you again. About 6 months or so ago on a little bit different topic, and I'm really thrilled to be back with you guys.
Well, excellent.
That was a great show that night, so I'm hoping we can continue the pattern.
Sure. Well, it's interesting that you reached out and wanted to address this topic with what you're doing with Revitalize the Second Amendment, and then we had the big NRA meeting in Houston, where Texas is from, in the same weekend, and I thought that speech that Ted Cruz gave, which we just played, just kind of laid it on the line. There is a Second Amendment. It is not up for negotiation. If you want to change it, there is Article 5 of the Constitution, but you can't just legislate it away. And clearly the anti-Second Amendment crowd went down in flames because of the stand of people like Rand Paul and Ted Cruz. So, you know, what are your thoughts on you know, the recent attempt at gun confiscation and gun restriction legislation? And, you know, how did we get here?
Well, it's certainly good steps that have been taken so far. you know, the Feinstein bill threat was something that many people took very seriously. And people need to realize, though, that there's a heck of a lot of other things that preceded that that are equally as egregious to the freedoms of the American people. And if you notice, we have a name for our organization that it actually leads people to one of two main directions when they hear it. Either, don't touch my Second Amendment, it's fine the way it is, or what do you mean it needs to be revitalized? That's usually the two comments that we get when we mention it to people. And the word revitalizing or revitalize means to bring life back to. And what we are specifically wanting to discuss and open up a national conversation is about that first clause, as you guys so aptly stated at the very beginning of the show. The first clause being a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms should not be infringed. And most people don't understand that that second phrase, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, is a subservient clause. It's supposed to be subservient to the first clause. And most people don't even have a clue that the first clause exists anymore. That's how much we've been trained away from the concepts in the first clause of the Second Amendment. What our organization is trying to do is to start by a re-education process. I'd like to take a moment and explain what I mean by re-education. It's not some kind of communistic or socialist term. It's actually a historical context. If you go back four or five generations, there was an absolute experiential knowledge of what well-regulated militia meant. And we have lost that understanding to the extent that we don't have any experiential knowledge of it anymore. The Greek word gnosko means to know by human experience. And we don't have human experience at all regarding the first clause of the Second Amendment, because we haven't experienced the first clause of the Second Amendment since the Dick Law of 1903 and subsequent militia acts after that that have completely changed the social structure of the country, the social-political structure of the country, to take away what is known as the militia of the several states in Article 2, Section 2, Clause 1 of the Constitution. Remember,
well, David, before we get into that, I think just to clarify, so what you're saying by re-education is sort of like the intellectual revolution that Ron Paul speaks of. He says, you
absolutely
know, that they may have defeated me, but they have not defeated my ideas, which aren't really his ideas. They come from Jefferson, Madison, and those guys. But you're saying that in 1903,
you dick,
they did something to change that paradigm, and now 110 years later, we've sort of forgotten what our inheritance is. We're joined by a couple of your partners in crime there. Yeah, constituents. We've got Jim Condit Jr. Joining us, Guardians of Liberty, Watch the Vote 2012, and we've also got Richard Fry, General Counsel for Revitalized Second Amendment, correct?
That's correct. I'd like to turn it over to Jim first, if you wouldn't mind, and let him share some things, because I know Jim's going to have to leave at the top of the hour, but Jim has a lot to say about this, and let's, Jim, pipe in if you were listening and share some thoughts to take what I've shared and go to the next level with it. You there, Jim?
Oh yeah, I'm here. Am I live?
You're live.
Oh, okay. Thank
you,
David.
Yes, you are. We can hear you loud and clear.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, thank you, David. I want to thank David and Richard Fry for spearheading this revitalizing the Second Amendment. You know, with the Watch the Vote thing that came together to try to get a fair count for Ron Paul and everybody else, then we, the people that came together and worked together on that, we did force the Iowa GOP to change its winner, thanks to Edward True, who was a local Iowan, who witnessed a 20-vote add-on for Romney that didn't exist in the computers that they used at the state, which were meant, the computers were used so they could crook the results. And he noticed in his little he was at the library, one of the 1,800 caucuses. He said, hey, he went home and looked at what they put in the computers. They gave Romney 20 more votes than he got, because I was there and I eyewitnessed it. And We hooked up with him. And since they claimed that Romney only won by 8 votes in the statewide, which means that they were really pumping his vote up everywhere, then we were able, with that 20, to basically force them to change their winner from Romney to Santorum. Now, in reality, I believe, fellas, that Ron Paul won. Michael Savage was going nuts the night before, saying Ron Paul wanted to kill all the Jews, and Michael Levin was going nuts. All these people who are neocons, basically, and love all these wars, they were so afraid that Ron Paul was going to win, because they knew the real intelligence on the ground in Iowa was that Ron Paul was getting 300 to 3,000 people everywhere, and the rest of the candidates could fit their little crowds in a Pizza Hut. That was a quote from somebody up there. Now, so here's the way they fixed it. I finally figured out the way the crooks at the Iowa GOP fix these things. Story County and I think Des Moines County, if I got my counties right, are the two counties around Des Moines. They make up half the precincts. And that's where they fixed it against Buchanan in 96, and that's where they fixed it against Ron Paul in 2012. So I believe Ron Paul really won. But my point is, so these people came together, by the grace of God, hooking up with one local activist, Edward Drew. We forced the GOP, first time in the history of the United States that we're aware of, that a major caucus had to change their winner 2 weeks after the result. But then we grew it and said, we want to develop a system that will be a plan for total victory if enough people get in it. And that's what's on the website of guardiansforliberty.com. But originally, it's a 7-point thing, honest elections, honest money, precinct. But then David Callahan, I went down to Tampa, okay, to the GOP convention as an observer. Judy Spady, one of our folks, was an alternate delegate. And David Callahan, at that point, I ran into him and met Richard Fry there, too. And David, in a late-night talk where I think I was falling asleep before he was, he refocused me on the fact that we needed to have the revitalization of the first clause of the Second Amendment, the well-regulated militia envisioned by the Founding Fathers to be under the authority of the governor. This is not people in fatigues running around on the weekend and, you know, they got the image, thanks to the news media, they want to maybe blow something up to make a point to the government and be anarchists. No, the Founding Fathers, not Richard Fry, not Jim Conda Jr., not David Callahan, the Founding Fathers wanted a well-regulated militia, which was every able-bodied man in some states between 18 and 45, under the authority of the governor for three reasons: to guard against foreign invasion, to help the population during earthquakes and natural disasters, but most importantly, the Founding Fathers were afraid of an overweening federal government becoming tyrannical, and then there would be this body of citizens to resist that. So this is an absolutely essential component. And let me just say one other thing here, because I appreciate you giving me time, because I do got to leave at the top of the hour due to another conference call that's scheduled every week. But if I could snap my fingers and focus patriots, concerned citizens, on two things. And right now, there's already 3 million plus Ron Paul supporters, 3 million NRA members. There's probably 20 million Americans who are alert enough to know that they want to do something, but they don't know what to do. I would say to all of them, do two things. One, pick your party, your Democrat or Republican party, even if you like another party better. Like, I like the Constitution Party. I hate the Democrat and Republican Party, but the Democrat and Republican parties control every county. That's the problem. And this is really the Goldman Sachs Fed banksters controlling every county. So I would ask people to get involved in the precinct, and be a Democrat or Republican, and go in there with your fellow citizens in your county and with a mind to overthrow peacefully through the precinct system, overthrow and change the party leaderships from the rhinos and the New World Order lackeys, even though some of them are too dumb to know it, that are in there now, to Ron Paul Constitution-type people. That's number one. Number two, join and work with revitalizing the Second Amendment so that we can get the state legislatures to start talking about reinstituting these militias that were taken away with the Dick Law of 1903 and reinstate them so that we have the sword and the sword and the sovereignty. The sovereignty would come through controlling the government again. The sword is to enforce it, and that's the name. Sword and Sovereignty is the name of Dr. Richard Vieira's book that explains all this. So if we could get all 3 million of the Ron Paul supporters to realize that these are the two things you do. You focus here, and we would have a chance, we'd be on the playing field and would have a chance within a few years to take back the country. All the other strategies, I contend, and I'm glad to engage in friendly debates with anybody on this, all the other strategies are not sufficient if you don't include the precinct project and the revitalizing the Second Amendment that David Callahan and Richard Fry are leaving. Without those two things, we will spin our wheels for the next 4 years. They'll be able to run easily rigged computer elections again because we won't be able to fix it through the precinct system, and you'll get some puke like Romney or McCain instead of having somebody that like Ron Paul that would actually have represented liberty. So let me end this filibuster and turn it back to you, Tex Rex. I appreciate you letting me have time to get that out. I always tell people, this is as much for my mental health to get this stuff out as it is to help educate people. So.
Well, that's
one of the reasons we're involved in this.
Yeah.
It's partly for our own mental health.
Right.
Otherwise, you're just yelling at the walls.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tex and I gave up yelling at the television by being just a couple of brown coats with a microphone, and getting a point of view across. So that I'm going to play devil's advocate here just so that, because sometimes people hear certain words. And, I think it's Frank Luntz who helps the rhinos sound conservative, who basically says it's not what you say, it's what they hear. And oftentimes, and I think of the story of the Tower of Babel in the Bible, where, let us confound their understanding. So sometimes we use words, but the person receiving them, it's like a buzzword that means something else to them. So generally speaking, when people have been conditioned to hear the word militia, they think of a bunch of rednecks in fatigues running around the woods with deer rifles, ready to shoot the first government official or post office truck that they see. Well, that's not what we're talking about. Secondly, you mentioned take the country back. People sometimes think that means, either take it back into the 17th century or take it back from somebody. But we're talking about taking it back to the original Constitution as originally constructed, which was a document given to us that isn't perfect, therefore it is amendable, but it is so well balanced between the dual sovereignty of the states and the federal government. But again, if the states don't have any ultimate recourse to force, then is that balance really there?
Yeah.
But you're not talking about these militias being like the private army of the governors, are you?
Well, the way the Founding Fathers and Richard Fry could come on and correct any nuances I have wrong is it would have been a state militia or state army under the authority of the governor, and that was their vision. And the reason for that was to let the states have a chance in case the federal government became overweening. So, yes, I understand that the state militias were meant to be a check and balance on a overweening federal government that might try to turn their army against the states. So maybe Richard could clarify that. But it's not lawless. It's in the Constitution. It would be law under the governor. And ideally, the state militias would be working in harmony with federal government and the armies and the Air Force. But they would have two different functions,
If I might
absolutely, and this is one of the problems where sort of the middle layer of control has been eliminated between the federal government and sort of a group of people getting together on the weekend playing guns. And I think most people think when they hear the term, militia, they think, oh, it's a bunch of, rednecks out there playing guns. And, oh, my God, that would be scary that these people are running around thinking that there's some sort of army or whatever. Well, all of that stopped with the Dick Act because the states used to have control of the militia, and the states would apportion a certain part of the state militia, which was well-regulated in the sense of drilled and trained and practiced, to the national government to fight the wars. And this comes down to the enumerated powers on the Constitution. So in Section 1, it says the Congress shall have the power to provide for the calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrection, repel invasion, to provide for organizing, arming, disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States. And then, of course, the states, you had the right, the states had the right to appoint the officers, the authority of training of the militia, and the discipline as prescribed by Congress. So the states really had control of these because this was the 50 states getting together to provide for the common defense. And this is something I think that's lost on the left, because the left gets upset when they're like, oh, why are we in Iraq? This is just because, you know, George Bush's father was attacked by, you know, Saddam Hussein or whatever it is. And they get upset at foreign adventurism. Well, you wouldn't have foreign adventurism if you had state militias, because the militias are the people. And the people don't want to run around planet Earth going and attacking everyone. They don't want to go invade Turkey or, you know, Sri Lanka or God only knows whatever. They would vote themselves and just say, you know, this is completely unnecessary and I prefer to stay home. And that was really the genius of the militia and the Dick Act destroyed all of that.
Yeah, and I actually believe that we probably need to hear from Richard Fry at this point, because I would never claim at this point in my life to be any kind of an expert on this stuff. But I just know the general idea is one that the founding fathers it was their idea, not my idea or your idea or David Callahan's. And secondly, that it makes sense. It makes sense that every able-bodied man, and of course you could open it to women who wanted to volunteer now too, be trained, because that was part of it, as I understand it. The sheriff could go around and collect a $20 fine, which was pretty good money in those days, from anybody that didn't show up for training. So the founding fathers envisioned not only that every able-bodied man be part of defending the country, but that they be well-trained to be able to defend the country. So that's about my understanding of it, and it makes common sense, but we probably need to hear from Richard now to give us any further clarifications, I would think.
Well, Richard's mic is open, but before I bring him on, just so that we're clear, because, you know, a lot of people have trouble with this because, you know, you said that people were getting fined if they weren't participating, which means that the militia isn't really a voluntary organization. We're talking here about a mandatory duty. So some people freak out, start thinking, okay, this is like, you know, conscription. You're forcing people into the military. However, we're not talking about a standing army that is set to go wherever the bankers decide they want to invade. We are talking about common security of your local community. And if you want to enjoy the liberty that is afforded to us in this great republic of ours, well, then the commensurate duty is that you have to defend it. And, you know, again, someone might have a conscientious objection to actually holding a weapon. Well, you know, maybe they could be a mechanic or a nurse, you know, but to enjoy the fruits of liberty without the duty to protect them doesn't make any sense. And the point that Tex made is very valid. I think that if this was truly state militias, I doubt that the president could call them up to go invade Iraq or Syria or anywhere else. But I'm fairly confident, if necessary, I'm sure that people from Arizona, Texas, New Mexico, and California would welcome people from Virginia, South Carolina, New Hampshire, and Michigan to help them defend our porous southern border.
Rex, this is David. Can I make a comment here? Because I think this could dovetail into Richard making a comment. Most of us still in America give some sense of respect to George Washington. I wouldn't say every American does, but I'd say the vast majority do. But let me read a quote by George Washington about this that would, I think, allow for Richard to then make some comments. He said, and this was in the paper that he and Henry Knox, who was Secretary of War, submitted to Congress in 1790 when they were attempting to lay out what the militia of the several states would look like within the new republic. And he said this, it may be laid down as a primary position and the basis of our system that every citizen who enjoys the protection of a free government owes not only a proportion of his property, but even of his personal services to the defense of it, and consequently that the citizens of America, with a few legal and official exceptions, should be born on the militia rolls, provided with uniform arms, and so far accustomed to the use of them that the total strength of the country might be called forth for any very interesting emergency. And to me, that says it all. And by the way, the militia of the several states, we have to emphasize, are governmental entities performing governmental functions and composed of members of the supreme governmental authority of this country, which is the people. And that's what the militia is. In fact, it's the only part of the federal government, of the constitutional government, which is actually the people. And the Dick Law and the subsequent Militia Acts took away that portion of our government. It totally changed it. And what they did, it wasn't that the federal government just changed it. They used, believe it or not, federal funds to get all of the states to change their laws to point their militias to the National Guard under the provisions for raising and supporting armies and not the provisions for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia. So that's where the change occurred.
Wow, that's it's amazing. And so this happened in 1903, correct?
Yes, that's when it began. It took from 1903 to 1933 to, as Dr. Edwin Vieira, who Jim mentioned earlier, Dr. Edwin Vieira in his book Sword and Sovereignty, he says the militias were transmogrified. That's the word that he uses.
Yeah.
Transmogrification. It's an awesome word, I think. So anyway.
Yeah. Ominous. Okay, so it was over over a 30-year period. This power of the various militias of the states was kind of eroded and nationalized into what is essentially a federal force now. And
yes,
interestingly,
and
that's also the same period of time in which we federalized the Senate. We cartelized our banking system, and we instituted a tax confiscation scheme and confiscated gold. So that's a pretty bleak 30-year period you're talking about. And I'd like to hear my co-host comments on that. But first, why don't we let Richard comment and kind of enlighten us on how this happened?
Well, first, let me say that all the things you just mentioned, I'm sure, are just a matter of coincidence. I'm sure that none of those things are related at all.
No.
But the militia is a concept that has been around for thousands of years. Frankly, it is an incident of sovereignty. And it springs from the principle of allegiance and protection, which means that in exchange for the loyalty and fidelity of the citizens or subjects, the sovereign is required to protect the rights and the interests of its citizens, including from invasion, from lawlessness, from disasters, and that's the basis of the militia. Our militia came up and was developed through the Anglo-Saxon races and cultures and the Norman culture through England. So that's where basically ours came from is from England. And again, it's an incident of sovereignty, but the federal government has no inherent sovereign power. It only has enumerated power. So it does not have a militia. The founders did not want it to have a militia. If you look at the Federalist Papers 27-28, that was done purposely. It was negotiated among the framers, and the idea was, with a militia being very suspicious of the power of a central government, having just fought off England, they did not want the central government to have a militia, but the states. And the thought was that, number one, it would reduce the necessity for a standing army in terms of size and how often, and then it would provide a counterbalance. And in the Federalist Paper 28, Hamilton actually lays out a battle plan for the states to get together with their militias and take on the federal government in war if, in the event that the federal government started oppressing the states. And that is unique to America, that the militia typically see was a defense of the sovereign, basically. But under America, that changed. The sovereign in England was, of course, the king, but the sovereign under America is the people.
Well, and that goes back to what they saw as the chief threat to the individual, which was a large state with a standing army, because that's what was going on in Europe, is you had all these standing armies sitting around doing nothing. And when they were sitting around doing nothing, they wanted to get to a war as soon as possible because war was profitable.
Well,
and
that's not only what was happening in Europe, that's what was happening in the colonies.
Yeah, exactly. those are European armies. And they said, look, if the citizens were the soldiers, the citizens wouldn't allow any of this to happen. you wouldn't have a permanent military class that gets its money strictly through war. You would have a bunch of people who have to leave their occupation in order to go engage in this activity, and therefore they would want to keep it as limited as possible, do the deed, and go the heck home. They wouldn't want, you know, war qua war for war's sake. They wouldn't want war to continue. That was the idea of the militia. And if the federal government had an army that it could use any time that it wanted to without the state's permission, then essentially liberty was gone. That was the beauty of the idea of the militia. And then when you get to 1903, all of that gets thrown out, and all of a sudden you have a standing army, and then, you know, well, look where we've been in the last 100 years, basically all over the entire globe, attacking pretty much every country on planet Earth.
What they did in 1903 was basically they called the militia the National Guard, and that was the beginning. And then through a series of other changes in the law, they basically converted what was then the militia called the National Guard. They converted that into a standing federal army, which is what you have now. Under the Constitution, see, the states are required to have a militia. Under their the principle of allegiance and protection, they're required to have a militia. They're also required to have a militia, the same militia, under the Constitution. And you've mentioned some of those provisions in the Constitution, including the Second Amendment, that requires the states to maintain their militia, including in the event the federal government needs to use it. But the Constitution limits the federal government's use. It can only use it in cases of rebellion or to put off an invasion or to execute the laws of the nation. And see, what we have now, the quote-unquote National Guard, under the one-force concept, is part of the standing army of the United States, and that's why you see the National Guard fought most of the war in Vietnam, and they're fighting most of the war in the Middle East right now. And that's legit. They can do that because it's part of the federal army. A militia, they cannot do that. They cannot send them out on an offensive war. They can only do defensive engagements. So they would not, and in fact, that's exactly what they did. That starting in 1903, they done away with the militia and changed them, and that was one of the reasons that they wanted to do it. They changed it so the federal government could send them overseas. That was one of the reasons they did that, so they can engage in excursions overseas.
Well, would it be possible, I mean, if there is a threat of invasion from overseas, to have a formal declaration of war by Congress and then use the Navy, which is, as far as I can tell, the only constitutionally legitimate branch of our military, and of course subsequently the Marines, and of course the Marines think that the Navy is nothing more than a taxi service for them, but then would it be possible to call up the militia to put down this force that might be planning an invasion of our shores?
Congress could do that. Congress could call forth the militia for that purpose. Right, Richard?
They can't do it from a practical standpoint because there is no regulated militia. There is no militia that is trained and equipped and prepared to fulfill that function.
But we should have one. That's the whole point of revitalizing this, correct? In other words, if we want to be secure in our liberty, then we have to provide that security, because if we don't, as sovereigns, then that vacuum is going to be filled by the federal power, and you're going to end up with a police state and a standing army that is going to seek foreign adventurism. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, the whole invention of fiat currency was in Massachusetts in 1690 because they sent their army on a pillaging expedition to Canada, and when they came back, they didn't have any money to pay them, so they started printing fake money. So it seems that that this idea of not having a militia and having that vacuum filled by a standing army also necessitates the fabrication of fake money, which is, you know, why the last 100 years of this country we've seen an erosion of our liberty. How did they get this Dick law, the Militia Reorganization Act or whatever it was called, passed, given the fact that it seems to be contrary to the Constitution? Wouldn't Article 5 have come into play?
It's not actually. And let me explain a couple of things. You are aware of who the president of the United States was at the time of the Dick Law being passed, right? It was Teddy Roosevelt.
Yeah.
And Teddy was very, very clearly disillusioned with the lack of strength of the troops that he had available to him in what's called the Battle of, it's actually the Battle of San Juan Heights. He wasn't on San Juan Hill, he was on San Juan Heights, which was the next set of hills over. But in his autobiography, and you can go and read an entire chapter in his autobiography where he talks about how disorganized things were when he was, he and Walter Reed was the colonel that was, or I guess he was then made a brigadier general. Or he served under Walter Reed, who, you know, the famous Walter Reed Medical Center was named after, who was a doctor, but was called up to be the commander of the forces going into Cuba. But anyway, you know, Teddy was very disillusioned with the lack of preparation, if you will, that the not only the militia but the volunteers and the standing troops had when they went and fought that war. And he states so very clearly that that was one of the things that really bothered him in his autobiography, and that it was necessary for us to create a better organized preparatory system in the United States. He had a gentleman by the name of his Secretary of War was a man by the name of Elihu Root, who was considered to be one of the most efficient Secretaries of War because he was a corporate lawyer, essentially, who went on to fame and fortune by being given the Nobel Peace Prize in 1913, interestingly, and was involved in international banking interests, which is also interesting. But anyway, the fact was, when they put this DICLA in place, what they did, I have a really technical term for what I perceive they did, and this is mostly from reading Dr. Vieira's work, by the way. I call it they snookered the legislatures of the 46 states at the time. And I've got some interesting articles that I found in the New York Times, believe it or not, written in 1908, which was the year that the DICLA law actually became was put into effect on January 21st, 1908. And interestingly, on January 1st of 1908 in the New York Times, there was an article titled "All Militia to Aid Army," and Lieutenant Colonel Weaver is certain that the states will accept the DICLA law. This is the title of the article, special to the New York Times. But one of the things in this article that's interesting is that in his annual report submitted today to the Secretary of War, Lieutenant Colonel Weaver was certain that the militias, the state militias, would satisfactorily comply by January 21st to the requirements to conform in their organization to the standards of the regular army if they are to share in the distribution of federal funds. And so that's, you know, again, it's this carrot that we constantly see Congress uses to get the states to do something. But interestingly, the next day, on the 2nd of January, Colonel Weaver said that there were two states who hadn't conformed yet, Delaware and Pennsylvania. Well, he actually missed one because New York had also not conformed to the DICLA law. And there was an article the next day on January 2nd in the New York Times that says to reorganize militia to conform to federal law, bill must pass before January 21st. And this was out of Albany, New York, dated January 1st, so it must have been in the Albany paper on January 1st. And it said that there was a bill to reorganize the National Guard and Naval Militia in harmony with the organization of the United States Army under the provisions of the DICLA law of 1903, was introduced in both houses of the legislature today, and was accompanied by a preliminary report of the Wainwright Commission. Wainwright was a representative in the state of New York. And he makes this statement, that actually the commission that he oversaw made this statement: an attempt by the state of New York to disregard the legislation of Congress and to ignore the federal law in the regulation of its militia is not to be thought of, obviously referring to the DICLA law, says the report. Such a course would be unpatriotic and a violation of the constitutional obligation, and it would not merely result in increase in the financial burdens of the state by reason of its failure to accept a share of the federal militia appropriation, but the efficiency and value of the National Guard as a state force would be gravely compromised. I'm quoting directly from the New York Times. What they did, Congress went to the provisions for raising and supporting armies and not to the provisions for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia in the Constitution, and they actually went to the provisions of Article 1, Section 10, Clause 3, which says that no state without the consent of Congress shall keep troops in times of peace. But The opposite of that is that if they've got the consent of Congress, they can keep troops in times of peace, and that's what Congress did in putting in place the Dick Law and the subsequent militia acts. And so what we see here is that Congress actually created an entity that the founding fathers never would have wanted to be put in place, and here's how they did it. In the Dick Law, they created two categories. The category of the organized militia, which was made up of the National Guard and the Naval Militia, and the second category, which they called in the Dick Law the reserved militia, which was anyone who was qualified but did not participate in being a member of the National Guard or Naval Militia. So they created these two categories in the Dick Law. Then they waited about 11 years, and in 1914, the Militia Act of 1914, they changed the wording. And you can see this wording in the United States Code, Title 10, Section 311, B1 and 2, where it says that they kept the first term the same. Organized militia is the National Guard and the Naval Militia, but they then created under B2 the unorganized militia of the United States. By the way, there is no such thing as the militia of the United States, but Congress created the militia of the United States, and they codified it in the statutes at large in the U.S. Code. And what they did in that sense was they created this new entity, and then they substituted this entity of the militia of the United States for the militia of the several states, which is the constitutional militia. And interestingly, the founding fathers talked about what were called select militias and said that they would be very dangerous to this country. George Washington even saying that if we ever move to a rotational militia, that it will become the end of the country. So it's just kind of interesting how the fathers were prescient in all of this. Anyway, that was my history lesson for the evening.
Well,
now I'll shut up.
Well, one thing I think is interesting is that you said all of this started under Teddy Roosevelt, back when he was engaged in the San Juan Heights, San Juan Hill.
Spanish-American War.
Yeah, exactly, the Spanish-American War. And what he found was that the well-regulated militia was ill-suited to the task of a unjustified imperialistic war against Spain. So he was like, hey, there's no real reason for us to be at war with Spain. We just kind of made up this war. And so now turns out that our military is not set up that way, so we need to create a military that's set up for imperialism. And I think the Founding Fathers would have said, well, that's not a bug, that's a feature.
Yeah, exactly. And it's also something that they would not have been at all interested in seeing. And, in fact, the American people weren't interested in it. See, they had to start by calling it the reserve militia. If they come right out and said unorganized militia, the people of this country would have gone nuts. They had to wait a period of time and allow people to get comfortable. I've got other documents from the Times that talk about how there were members of the militia who refused to serve in the National Guard. There were some cooks as late as 1915 that refused to serve in the maneuvers of the summer by cooking for the troops, for the maneuvers, the National Guard maneuvers. And it was a big fiasco that was still being discussed in the press as late as, 10 or so more years after the Dick Law was passed. So this was not a happy change. There's one other thing I want to point out, and this is a key point when it has to do with that phrase, well-regulated militia. And I don't know if it was Tex or Rex, I can't remember which one of you mentioned this, that that's talking about them being organized and trained and equipped. But interestingly, that phrase is not really properly understood today in our country. And Dr. Vieira, in his book, The Sword and Sovereignty, points to this on pages 71 to 73 in a very interesting way, because see, that word's not defined in the Constitution, or the militia's not defined in the Constitution. Well, regulated militia is not defined in the Bill of Rights, in the Second Amendment. So the question is, how did the American people know what that meant? There are several terms that aren't defined, but Congress is defined, the two legislatures are defined, the president's defined, the Supreme Court's defined, but many terms are not.
Those were all innovations of the Continental Congress, but the militia was already existing.
Yes, but it goes further than that. Well-regulated militia is the term, and people knew exactly what it meant. And let me give you a reason why. If you go to the Rhode Island statutes, and Dr. Vera actually lists these on pages 71 to 73, he quotes the titles of some of these statutes that were actually in the Rhode Island and the Virginia law. In 1699, 1701, and 1705, there's a statute that says this: an act for the better regulating the militia and for punishing offenders as shall not conform to the law thereunto relating. You ever heard of that before? Or how about this one, 1718, 1730, and 1744? An act for repealing several laws relating to the militia within this colony and for further regulation of the same. The people of America understood what well-regulated meant. It meant well-defined by statutory law in the state laws. Here's another one in 1779. So this is after the Declaration, but before this would have been during Articles of Confederation. Whereas the security and defense of all free states essentially depend under God upon the exertions of a well-regulated militia, wherefore, for the better forming, regulating, and conducting the military force of this state, be it enacted, quote, an act for the better forming, regulating, and conducting the military force of this state, end quote. So well-regulated militia was a very clear term of art that every American, because every male citizen, had to conform to it, and that was the regulations of their state. Just like we got regulations for traffic, you know, for our transportation laws. We got regulations for food. We have regulations for, I mean, everything that we are regulated by ad nauseum today. The people of up until 1903 clearly understood that the well-regulated militia was by law what they were required to do. And here's one other point, and I'll close with this. Did you know that between 1788 and 1903, the federal government actually provided the military weapon for every citizen that was part of the militia of the several states?
Mm-hmm. David?
Jim,
this is
go
Jim
ahead.
Conda Jr. I'm going to have to go. I wanted to say one thing before I left, though. In about a week or two, on the Revitalizing the Second Amendment website, which is RT, the number 2A, it's kind of an abbreviation, RT to the number, RT2A.org, everyone can join for a very modest membership fee every year, and I am urging every person that is concerned about our country to join, and if they can afford it, pay the membership fee, the modest membership fee to our Revitalizing the Second Amendment, because this is the muscle that we need to enforce our victories at the precinct level and the delegate level. The reason Ron Paul's forces won a lot of these delegate gatherings and then were cheated out of them by a judge or something is because there was nothing to back them up, and the crooked judges just took it away from them. If the militia was there, judges and party leaders would think twice before they started to cheat people out of legitimate victories that they had won. So I just want to say that it's this important, and it will also put pressure on the NRA, who is avoiding this issue so far, and even Gun Owners of America, despite Larry Pratt's excellent statements on national TV and elsewhere constantly. They need to pick this up. And Dr. Edmund Vieira, whose work David and Richard are basing, his books are kind of the basis for people to get educated. He's probably the foremost constitutional scholar in the country, if not one of them, if not the. And he's won two cases before the Supreme Court, and he lost the third, and he tells us he was cheated out of that one, and I believe him. Everyone join up, and for the two reasons I said, to be a member and swell the ranks of those understanding this, and to put pressure on the larger groups to address this issue. And so Texan Rex and David, everybody, Richard, thank you very much, and we'll talk to you next time, okay?
Thank you very much for joining us.
Okay. If I might dovetail off that, and I appreciate Jim mentioning the website because
I would like you to jump on that, but just to clarify to people.
Yeah, go ahead.
Going to the website and joining, you are not joining any militia. You are joining an organization to restore the state militias, just so that everybody's clear on that.
Thank you. That's very good. In fact, we are not the militia. We make it very clear. And by the way, joining the organization isn't just so we can get a few dollars from people. There are some tremendous benefits that will be coming out of this organization. We are not a sit back and just rant and rave and protest organization. We are creating a structure that will allow people to do something very vital. And this really is the key point. And as Jim mentioned, the book that we are using, as we're calling it the manual for the organization, is Dr. Edwin Vera's excellent book, Constitutional Homeland Security, which he wrote in 2007, and it's virtually not being used by anybody in the country that we know of at the moment. We think that this is an excellent tool. And in fact, we've created within the organization what we call Citizen Homeland Security Association chapters, which is what Dr. Vera calls them in his book. And he's got seven chapters in the book that are dealing with how you set up and how you utilize these Citizen Homeland Security Association chapters to get things done in your local area. And what we are doing in Florida, where I am, is we're organizing, starting in Tallahassee, where I live, we've started one of these Citizen Homeland Security chapters, and we're bringing people together in the local community. We've had 15 meetings so far, and all we're doing is we're re-educating the people, helping them to get the same mentality that our forefathers 4 or 5 or 6 generations ago had about what the purpose of the body politic was within our local communities. For instance, what would we ever do if the power grid goes down in our local community? Are we prepared for that kind of a thing? I live in Florida. We get hit with hurricanes pretty often. What do we do when the hurricane comes through our town? Are we ready for that kind of a situation? I mean, we know what happened with Sandy hit Staten Island. I mean, they're still trying to figure out how to fix that town. What if the people of Staten Island had a group of people getting together on a regular basis and putting together a plan, a security plan, a emergency plan, where all the people knew what they would do if there ever was a hurricane to hit, their town? I mean, that's what we're talking about here. This isn't all about just having arms. This is about how are we as people prepared for whatever any very interesting emergency, as George Washington called it, happens in our local towns.
Yeah, but if you did that, then what would all those people who work for FEMA and DHS have to do?
Well, they could take care of Washington, D.C.
Okay, they'll descend on the 10-mile square across the Potomac. I think it's a very vital point, and this is I'm glad you made it, because people do miss this. And the fact is that life is risk. It's not only the danger of terrorists and foreign invasion or potentially some homicidal maniac. We've got natural disasters. We've got man-made disasters. We've got technological disasters. Things happen to impede things all the time. One of the largest sectors of our economy is the insurance business, because we buy insurance to mitigate the extreme cost of the losses that we face because of these things. And yet, isn't it our responsibility to take care of our family, our neighborhood, our community? And what you're talking about here is that it is the responsibility of the community, the locality, the township, the county, and the state to organize these things so that resources can be deployed to where they're needed without people running around like chickens without heads, but actually knowing what to do. And if we are trained as a militia to be those first responders, then we don't need to borrow trillions from the Federal Reserve to set up a federal bureaucracy that never manages these things well.
And as Dr. Vieira says, which I think this is an awesome statement, now you have to give him credit because, he's the one that first said it in a video. We have a DVD series by Dr. Vieira that's available on our website. We don't get a penny from it. He gets his royalty from it. The people that produced it get their money. But in that video, he talks about, if we were to put back the structure, let's suppose that there was some kind of a major catastrophe that hit the state and the people from the Department of Homeland Security, the FEMA group, calls the governor and says, "Governor, we're going to bring in a bunch of our people, 5,000 of our people, to help you with this particular disaster." The governor could turn to the FEMA representative and say, "We really appreciate that, but we've got 150,000 trained militia in our state that can take care of this problem. Thank you very much. And as much as we love you, we don't need you."
As it was intended.
Which is what it ought to be.
The original intent.
Homeland Security is not supposed to be some bureaucratic establishment out of Washington, D.C. that's telling the rest of us what to do. Homeland Security is supposed to be a bottom-up or ground-up organization that is made up of the people of the community who are closest to the disasters, who are there where the issues are, dealing with the problems, But having and be invested, and that term, by the way, meant to put on the vest of authority, be invested to do what's necessary with the authority to do so. I was a victim of a hurricane in Florida in 2004, Hurricane Charley. It destroyed my home, and I've experienced FEMA. Long before Katrina, I already had experienced the nonsense that they experienced in New Orleans. And I literally talked to hundreds of FEMA representatives who always told me the same thing. I have no authority. And that's the nonsense of what these FEMA people are doing. They come in and they bring in supplies, but when you come to them with real problems, they say, you're going to have to go talk to this guy because I don't have any authority to do anything. That is nonsense. We need to get to a place where the people who are closest to the problem have the authority to get the job done. And by the way, the bottom line of all this, we need to get organized. This is about being organized and doing it in such a way that we can take care of ourselves. Thank you very much. That's the American spirit. That's the way that we've operated, you know, throughout our history when we've been given the opportunity to do so. I had the chance to talk to my representative last year and presented this whole concept to her here in my local legislative district. And it was an interesting conversation. We walked away from it. She thought that it was a great idea to pursue this or at least have some further conversation. She said, David, I really like the idea. Would you do one thing? Could you take that word militia out of it? And see, but you can't take away that term because that's the constitutional term. By the way, it's in the state constitutions as well as the federal constitution. It is the established term, and you'd be unconstitutional to not go there.
I'm trying to wrap my head around the concept that you presented to a congressperson, the original intent of the constitution. They're like, wow, that's an interesting idea.
Well, yeah, like you came up with it.
It's also the freaking law.
Yeah, this was state representative, not federal. You know, this wasn't.
Well, she should still know the law. She should still know the law, and they shouldn't be squishy and politically correct the word militia. Look, I mean, the fact that words like militia, sovereignty, state's authority, conservative, constitutionalist have been co-opted and perverted doesn't mean that we should stop using them. We should just emphasize their original meaning and take them back, because the very simple fact is that, you know, why do we dispatch the National Guard when there's a disaster? Because they're organized in a way that they can respond. But if the militia was there, then you wouldn't need to federalize it and you would take care of it. Now, this is interesting, and it's the top of the hour, so I'm going to throw out the number. We'll quick do some housekeeping, then we'll get back in the conversation. This is the Tex and Rex Show, and if you want to call in, the call-in number is 646-649-1013, and we are talking about revitalizing the Second Amendment with David Callahan and Richard Fry. This is what I want to ask you. You've got the organization. People have joined so that we can get organized and start presenting these, oddly enough, as Tex put it, presenting the existing law to our elected idiots so that they might actually implement the law as it is. You know, other than joining, what can people do to educate themselves, and then what so that, you know, people have kind of a goal in mind and they understand what we're talking about? This isn't just an intellectual conversation or historical discussion. Where is this supposed to go beyond just militia and emergency response if we adhere to our God-given sovereignty, as also guaranteed by our state and federal constitutions? What does that do for our electoral process, and what does that do for this spread of federal tyranny that we're seeing everywhere, that every time there's anything that makes us, you know, that goes bump in the night, we want to lock down a city with militarized police? How will that play out for us? What's the goal here?
I want to defer to Richard. I have an answer to that, but Richard, do you have a thought you'd like to share, just because I've been talking for a little bit here, but I'll be glad to go on, but do you have a few thoughts?
Well, I think ultimately what will happen is you're going to see a defederalization and militarization of the state law enforcement and more reliance upon the militia, and the counterpart to the militia, which is the posse comitatus. They're basically the same people. They have a different function, and they operate over a different geographical area. But that's what we need to return to, is the self-sufficiency of the state, and demilitarize it and defederalize it.
The thought that I was going to bring to the table here is, you know, think about the different types of threats that we deal with. We have a threat that's not just this paramilitary police state threat, which is, in many of our opinions, the greatest one, but there's other threats. There's the drug cartel threat that is obviously a threat by other nations to undermine the American socioeconomic system, but through a entire system of providing all kinds of drugs and paraphernalia into this country for the purposes of destroying the infrastructure of our country. And I know where you guys stand, and I stand on, and where this whole thing should be at the moment. But that's a threat that we're experiencing tremendously in this country, as well as what the general government is doing to try to stop it and how much that's doing good. Then you've got there's an economic threat. In fact, that the threat of that we're seeing of the diminishing of the dollar, the value of the dollar, people today understand that we're in a very volatile situation economically. There's a economist by the name of Kolakoff who back in 2008 put out a paper through the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, in which he said that the total amount of our debt was over $65 trillion. It's probably much higher than that now, because that was even prior to the TARP and all the other things that have been going on with the Fed and so on. Those numbers are probably arguably up in the $100 trillion range by now. We've got the immigration threat that we're talking about right now, and in Congress have been for several years. This has been going on. You have the gang threat that's going on in many municipalities in this country. You have all these different threatening issues, and the question is, how are we engaging these issues? What are we doing to put together within our communities vital means of addressing those issues? In the states or in the federal government, they put together all kinds of quote-unquote programs to try to deal with these things, but it never trickles down to the local community individuals. And let me go back and address a point that you raised a little earlier, and that's this issue of conscription. Conscription initially in this country was in the militias. That was where the men of this country were originally conscripted. And by the way, gun control wasn't a matter of you being told what you couldn't have in your home. You were told what you must have in your home. That was gun control. We've got this thing flipped entirely on its head. And the purpose
was... Not the only thing we flipped.
Yeah, really, exactly. But the point is that that all of this was put in place because we understand that when you have proper self-defense, you don't have somebody else's defense. You're not depending on somebody else to protect you when the particular action occurs. You can protect yourself. For example, the situation with George Zimmerman and Trayvon Walker, which everybody in the country knows about now because of the Stand Your Ground law and how,
Trayvon Martin.
Yeah, Trayvon Martin. I'm sorry. I said the wrong name. I apologize. But anyway, but that whole incident could have been, had there been well-regulated militia, meaning that there was very clear statutory authority for the vesting of particular individuals within the community, and I'm just saying this is a theoretical, response to that, where there was a citizen neighborhood watch, authority within a militia structure to protect communities, then whoever that person that had that militia authority for that particular watch would have been, he would have been in proper garb, so he would have been easily identified as having had that authority, and there would not have been the provocation that resulted in a man shooting another man because, he would have seen that this man had asked the question having the authority to ask the question. He would have backed down, said, "Sir, I'm just in the area. I went and got myself an iced tea and some candy at the store, and I'm going back to my girlfriend's house." You hear what I'm saying? In other words, a lot of the things that we think are just issues where people are being vigilante would be dealt with in an organized manner within our communities, and by the way, through proper statutes, proper laws. In the state of Georgia, there's two towns where there's actually statutory authority. I can't remember what the town is. Goshen, Georgia, was it? I think that may not be the right town. But just a couple of weeks ago, they put in place a law that every citizen must have a gun and ammo in their home. And Kennesaw has been doing that for years. And so there is the ability to have laws that actually regulate what the people are required to do in these regards. And all we're saying is, give us back our laws. Let us be law-abiding citizens who follow the law, practice the law, and are involved in the political process to help create these laws in a way that makes sense. So what these Citizen Homeland Security Associations will do is we will sit down, we will evaluate all of these issues, and we will put together what we think would be a reasonable way to reenact the law the way it ought to be today versus 110 years ago. One other thing that I said to my representative when I visited with her, I asked this question: what is the number one resource of the state of Florida? And interestingly, she comes from the left side of the aisle, but she happens to be on the Natural Resource Committee of the state. So I knew I kind of had her cornered. And she went on about, I can't remember exactly what she said, something to do with the monetary, our financial resources or whatever. And I said, no, it's not that at all. It's the people of the state of Florida. Are we using the people of the state? Are we utilizing the most important resource we have, the most vital resource that we have, in the most efficient way we possibly can? And the answer is no. We're not using our people at all. And it ought to be a duty of our people in our states. And by the way, what would this do for civic pride and for a sense of ownership of our states again and our communities? I think it would be tremendous. And
well,
we do in this
organization. It's essential. It's essential for a republic. I mean, if a republic is the rule of law, where even the highest officers of government are under that law, then that law has to have an enforcement function. And the fact is that that's just a natural thing, and a vacuum will be filled if one is created. And there are two extreme aspects of it. The first one is total statism, where the central authority has a monopoly on power. I mean, gun control isn't about taking away guns. Gun control is merely about who has all the guns. And so the federal government wants all the guns. They want to confiscate our ability to own them, and therefore they have a monopoly on force. On the other extreme, you have no government authority, and so therefore everybody is their own force, and then of course you're going to have people coalesce into gangs, and it's going to be kind of a warlord type situation, the perfect
like
balance.
Like Chicago
well, exactly.
has right now.
That's exactly what it is. That's why the murder rates are so high.
Yeah, that's why we have a good model of why you don't want to go there.
So precisely by having, and this is probably an alien concept for a lot of Americans to understand because of one, the quote, taught respect for police, and I'm not saying we should disrespect police, but I mean the fact that it's almost this us versus them. You know, the police have the authority and the power, and we're there, we have to comply with them, whereby if the militia exists, then we are essentially policing ourselves. And the important thing there is that if the militia is drawn from the local populace, then they are invested in order of that community as opposed to standing against it versus a kind of a foreign force brought in. So it creates a balance, and it keeps at bay both the gangs or the warlord situations like Chicago, and it keeps at bay the desire out of fear for a police state. So, you know, but people sometimes don't understand how can this be mandatory? If we're free, then are we not free to pass on this militia? But freedom has a price, doesn't it? I mean,
yes,
you're going to have to pay for it.
Citizenship has always carried responsibility. It always has. It's carried the responsibility to come to the call of the sovereign in times of invasion and lawlessness, and it's no different now. The problem is that the citizens aren't undertaking that personal responsibility. It's being shoved off to the central government, and it's not working out very well.
Well, exactly.
Well,
this comes back to the central problem, which is that everything was given over to the citizens and the citizens of the state. They were state citizens. In order to solve these problems, and over time the citizens were like, well, but I don't want to pay attention. And so they transferred authority further and further up the chain into where the power distance is so great that now there's no communication. It's very difficult to communicate with the higher levels of authority in society, and people feel
that, oh, well, it seems like Washington doesn't listen. They're not listening to the people. They don't hear my voice, and they're not doing what we want. Well, yeah, of course, because you transferred power so far away from you by your acquiescence, your silence, and by going home watching TV instead of getting involved, that now nobody needs to listen to what you have to say. And now there's people are sitting around feeling powerless. Well, of course you're powerless. You transferred your power away.
Thomas Jefferson said that the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. And unfortunately, at some point in the not too distant past, but over 100 years ago, some people, in whatever way, our fathers slept on their watch. They let their guard down. They didn't keep themselves in a position to make sure that we didn't have something done that undermined the Constitution and our liberty. And unfortunately, that happened. And there's nothing you can do to say that they were good or bad in that regard. They just did. But what we have to do now is we need to step up and be willing to take back that place that we should be moving toward of revitalizing the liberty that we take for granted. I'm old enough to remember when things were a little bit freer. You felt a little bit safer than we do today. And we're on a slippery slope now. That if we don't turn this around, we're just going to continue to have an increased feeling of threat and fear and a lack of certainty about how our society is supposed to operate. And we're just going to move toward, the police state and the paramilitary power. It's just where it's going to go.
Yeah.
And by the way, where does that ultimately lead to? What was the number one killer of people in the 20th century? Democide. Government killing of people by government. By far the greatest killer in the 20th century.
It might be the number one killer in the 21st century, too.
It may well be if we don't do something about it now.
Yeah.
I was just going to jump in, Rex, real quick and say, the cost of eternal security or the cost of security is eternal Doritos and television. And
yeah.
That's the price people have been paying, and they're not paying enough attention. And now that they feel powerless and like they can't do anything about it or reverse course. Well, because you've transferred more and more power over to the state, and this is what the Founding Fathers were concerned about. But you haven't transferred it over for good. All the levers of power and authority are still there. You just need to start getting involved and start exerting that authority, and you can turn this thing around. I mean, that's the beauty of the system. I think people are just now waking up to that. They're realizing, like, well, my God, it's getting really late, but it's sort of like, Churchill was saying, is that Americans try all the solutions, the worst ideas first before they finally try the best solution. And I think people are coming around to that.
Well, fortunately, Dr. Vieira has done some tremendous work for us. We don't have to rebuild a wheel here. We've got some tools available through our website and our Facebook page that are very useful for people to get a handle on this stuff very easily. He's been writing about this subject in a public forum since 2005. He's got over 140 articles on newswithviews.com, and many of those are just tremendous in and of themselves, and they've been there for years. People can go and read them without paying a penny. In my mind, the most important thing that everybody listening to this conversation tonight can do is start educating yourself. You don't have to become part of our organization. I mean, we we'd love you to participate with what we're doing. But if all you did was went and read through those articles that Dr. Vieira has on newswithviews.com, you would be way ahead of the curve. Tremendously, you'd have such a eye-opening experience. That's where I began. I just started reading his articles. When I started reading his articles, I realized, I've got to get more understanding of this. And by the way, I've been studying the Constitution most of my life. I was going to gun shows in 2008 and passing out copies of the Constitution, talking about the Second Amendment, and I didn't even understand the Second Amendment until it was after that that I became acquainted with Dr. Vieira, and I got his book, Constitutional Homeland Security. I started to watch his videos where he presents these concepts in a very articulate, well-thought-out, very methodical manner, explains a lot of things. And then recently he's come out with this new book, The Sword and Sovereignty. All of those resources are available on rt2a.org. And many videos and conversations that he's had recently we have on the Facebook page, which is facebook.com/rt2a.org. So, you know, nobody has to be in the dark. If you just go there and start learning this stuff, start and turn off the television, you know, stop, sitting around watching, Family Guy or whatever, and take and absorb your mind in some things that are going to be, you know, possibly the way by which we're able to save this, you know, ourselves from this mess that's coming at us. That's the best thing that you can possibly do, and that's what we're encouraging people to do. Plus, if you take his book, Constitutional Homeland Security, and start reading it, you'll know how to, when we start opening up within our organization, the Citizen Homeland Security Association chapters, which we want to put in every legislative district in every state, you'll be in a position where you'll be able to become involved in the leadership and help bring others together to do the things that we got to do. See, we're going to have to actually start sitting down and architecting what this law is going to look like in each of the states. And it's going to be different in every state because every state has different geographical qualifications. States that are totally landlocked are not going to have the same requirements as a state that's got, you know, like Florida, where we're surrounded by water on three sides. Or if you're in Colorado and you've got the mountains, or you're in the prairies of the Midwest or whatever.
If you have a foreign border.
Yeah, if you have a foreign border or a northern border, whatever. You know, it's different for every state. Plus, the citizens of your state, if you've got a large immigrant population in your state, if you've got the threat of that, or you have a lot of gang activity in your state, and let me throw in one other one I should have mentioned. What about this economic, and I did mention it briefly, but let me go a little further with it. This whole economic crisis that we're seeing coming at us at full force. What if you could put in place an economy in your state that would have perhaps constitutional money provisions, going back to the fact that, you know, the Constitution says that no state will use anything but gold and silver coin for the payment of debt, which we haven't been doing for a significant amount of time. What if you could put back that kind of a provision where, because you have a well-regulated militia, you have in place an economy put in place to be able to handle it? Because what would you use to pay the fines, the militia fines, or your whatever fees that you have to pay as a militia member? Or what about if all the members of the militia that were businessmen and women actually had an alternative payment schedule that they provided at the militia meetings for people to buy their goods and services in gold and silver? The first state that does this is going to have an incredible economic advantage over every other state in the country.
Well, it doesn't look like it's going to be Arizona, because Janet Brewer just vetoed a hard currency bill that they passed through the legislature there. But real quick, all of the websites and articles and books that have been mentioned, you can find them by going to the Tex and Rex Show page on Facebook. That's the Tex and Rex Show on Facebook. And if you like that page, you will get notifications of when we are broadcasting, and there's also links there to all the articles, clips, and websites that have been referred. So it's a one-stop resource for everything on the show. So just go to the Tex and Rex Show page on Facebook, like that page, and also there's the Tex and Rex's Liberty Militia. If you join that group, all of the articles are posted in there, and so that you have the resources to follow up on this conversation, because, you know, ultimately this is just talk unless you act. And as you've been told, you know, educate yourself and learn. That's very important, because you don't want to run around ignorant. You want to be an informed American, sovereign American citizen. But ultimately all the knowledge that you acquire is of no use unless you act. And this is your country. You have to be the one responsible for making it happen. Don't worry about what other people don't know. You learn and you share the information with them, because, you know, you have two choices here. You can either succumb to chaos and vigilantism, and we've seen it. Every time there's a disaster, whether it's natural or a power grid goes down or anything like that, you've got looting, you've got violence, you've got rape. It happens. In places like Chicago, that's just, you know, par for the course. That's normal course of affairs, since everything is so chaotic there. The other option is you have Muslim jihadists out there who are, in fact, trying to kill us, And even if we withdraw from all of our foreign adventurism, which will ultimately happen because we'll run out of money, that's not necessarily going to stop them from wanting to hurt us. And so you need to have the provisions for security here. If you don't provide it, then you're opening up the door for exactly what we saw in Boston on a scale like we've never seen before. And if that scares you, then you need to be the one who stands in that breach and make sure that that doesn't need to happen. And if it doesn't scare you, it will. Tex?
Yep.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, we're talking tonight a lot about the Second Amendment. We're also talking about the issue of militias and everything. But, you know, this is something that needs to be defended. It's actually one of the critical breaks on Central Power, but all of the Bill of Rights need to be defended. And we are now living in an age where we're called to remember these things and to come to the defense of them for the safety and security of the nation, to secure for the next generation. So I would encourage people to get involved on this issue, but, you know, you're encouraged to get involved on all the issues because we really need a constitutional revival going on in this country. This is something that, you know, a lot of people, and I think Ron Paul really actually kind of, you know, seized the mantle on this issue of returning us to constitutional government, and now it's sort of reverberating throughout the country. And, you know, I'm talking to people recently, someone who was on the left, you know, just ran into this person, happened to be talking to them, and they said, oh, yeah, well, Ron Paul has all these crazy ideas and everything, and we sat there and we started talking about things, and they're on the left, and they're like, yeah, well, I agree with a lot of that. And there's a lot of common ground that can be built once you get past the idea of party, but once you get to the idea of principle, you can find a lot of common ground with your fellow Americans, and that really is what the Founding Fathers were talking about. So I think that is part of what we're trying to build here and what we're trying to put in place.
There's two things that you guys, what you guys have just talked about, bring to my mind. Firstly, what is America known for, the American people known for in the broad scheme of things over the entire, isn't it rugged individualism? In other words, that people have made something of themselves in this country simply because they've decided, I'm going to do something to better myself, I've got the opportunity to do so, and by golly, I'm going to figure out a way to do it. And
pioneering spirit.
This is a great opportunity for rugged individualism to once again come to the surface. People can take an issue here, and they can learn about it. They can become involved in it, and they don't have to care what anybody else does. If we had, you know, all the rugged individualists in this country coming together, we could solve a tremendous problem here in a very short period of time. And I really want to encourage everybody to, you know, think about what you can do personally to be part of the solution to this problem, as opposed to being part of the problem, which is to, you know, be ambivalent, to be irresponsible, to not care. And the other thing I want to mention is, you know, we're focusing a lot these days on the Constitution because of what Ron Paul has brought back to the forefront. But, you know, the real issue here is, are we going to continue to live in a state of lawlessness in this country? Because when you're not abiding by the Constitution, it's essentially living in a state of lawlessness. The Constitution is a statute. It's as a document, it's a statute which defines how our government is supposed to operate. And when we don't abide by that document, we're living in a state of lawlessness. And how much of the Constitution do we not follow when it says in plain terms, which the document was written for the yeoman farmer of the day who was really a very educated man, but it was the common man of the country was who the document was written for. And it was written in such a way that we can simply read it and understand what it means. Now, yeah, there might be a few terms that had a slightly different meaning in that day, but the meaning that it had in that day is still the meaning that it has. And we just need to understand what that meaning is, and we need to figure out how we can apply it. The words are not going to change, just the way in which it's applied may have a different tone to it. For instance, we're not going to just simply go out there with muskets and tomahawks if we revitalize the militia in 2014. We're going to use the weapon of the day. You know, so there's certain aspects of which will be modernized, but the principles of it will still be the same. By the way, there was another point that I thought of that when you asked that question about, you know, how does this all flesh out? Well, we've got a major problem in this country with black box voting. And while it may or may not be that we would put the militia in place to deal with that, what it will do is it will open up a conversation. You know, when people go to their mustering within a militia organization within the state, they're going to be called to muster on a regular basis. What is that going to mean? They're going to be getting together and talking about the issues of their community. And they're going to go, you know what? I'm really concerned about the way we vote and the fact that we don't even know who's elected to offices because we can't see the ballots. And they're going to start talking about how we fix these problems. That's a tremendous benefit of having militia back. By the way, if you think about the long timeline from the early 1900s, the first thing that they had to do is start diffusing the militia to several states. We didn't have any alphabet agencies prior to 1903, except perhaps you could say we did have the IRS because there was a revenue agency all the way back to the original income tax, which, by the way, was all the way back in 1862, if you didn't know that.
Yeah, but it was illegal.
Yeah, well,
and
it
still
was,
is.
The income tax is another subject we could talk about another time. But the point is that all those alphabet agencies, the FBI, the NSA, the AFTBE, they even had letters as you go on. All those agencies didn't even come into play until the militia of the several states was removed and replaced with the National Guard. And so you see that that was a critical step in a process that somebody knew what they were doing, even if it wasn't in the good of the American people. And we need to realize that this is something that vitally needs to be put back in the measure that it originally existed if we're going to see ourselves get to a place of civility again.
Well, absolutely. I mean, if you're functioning without the strictures of the Constitution, you're functioning without basically a doctrine of law, and therefore you essentially have a lawless government, which is what the Founding Fathers were fighting against. You don't want the capriciousness of kings, but we've reached an age all of a sudden in our own lifetime where people who are elected to positions of authority don't seem to think that the founding documents have any relevance to them anymore, and that they'll just decide whatever they want to do, and they will just do it. This gets back to one of the critical issues that I think, something that often got overlooked in the 17th Amendment. By making these senators popularly elected, they became just like presidents. But they became the consuls for the state. The consul was sort of the equivalent of like a president in the ancient Roman system, but there were always two of them. So the states essentially have consuls, but we just call them senators. And these people, now that they're properly elected, what they want to do is get out ahead of every issue. So no matter what the issue is, if it's a tsunami in, you know, Papua New Guinea, if it's urban housing crisis in Chicago, they have a solution. Whatever's on the headlines, you're going to have some senators jumping out there trying to get ahead of the issues so they can get their name out there, they can ride that to some sort of electoral victory. And what we used to have was the states would decide how they picked the senators, but a lot of them allowed the state legislatures to pick them. It's a system that can be corrupted, but all systems can be corrupted. But the thing is, the critical thing to consider is that if the state legislature is picking those senators, they're certainly not going to pick senators who transfer state authority away from the state to the federal government. They'll recall them.
And they also would be concerned. They'd also be concerned about what the states want them to be voting on in Congress, not just looking at, you know, polls and just trying to, you know, get the you know, which way the wind is blowing to determine what they're going to be voting for. They're going to be very concerned about what the state's interests are when they vote.
Exactly, they will look after the prerogatives of the states versus the central government, whereas the president is going to be popularly elected. He's always going to promise, I will bring home so much bacon, you can't even believe how much bacon I'm going to bring home. The House of Representatives is always going to be about how they're going to help their district, and I'm going to do everything to make sure that I help the district. The Senate was there as the brake, the cooling saucer, as the Founding Fathers said, on the passions of the people. It's the only body that has that. And once they got rid of that, look at what happened to federal authority. It exploded because there was no state voice in the federal government. And we have functioned really without a state voice in the federal government ever since then. And look at what it's come to.
Mm-hmm.
And interesting to note that, that amendment would have likely been difficult to pass if the militias of the several states were still around, if not for the Dick Act of 1903. And as you said, it came about in 1908. Well, it was 1913 that the 17th Amendment went through. I doubt that we're going to get that amendment repealed by the Senate and the Congress, but I suppose
right.
the states would have incentive to repeal it as they did prohibition. But again, all of the principles that are enshrined in the Constitution ultimately have no validity in practical nature whatsoever unless you have ultimate recourse to force. Without the state militias, the only force is the federal force. In fact, Elbridge Gerry said, "What, sir, is the use of a militia? Is it to prevent the establishment of a standing army?" It is to establish standing army, the bane of liberty. Now, it must be evident that under this provision, together with their other powers, Congress could take such measures with respect to a militia as making a standing army necessary. Whenever governments mean to invade the rights and liberties of the people, they always attempt to destroy the militia in order to raise an army upon their ruin. That just encapsulates
it
right there.
That's it.
Why they don't want it.
And, you know, guys, what really the main focus at this time of our organization is what you guys have been so great about. And I really want to tell you that we appreciate the message that you guys are trying to help get out there. People have to get the term defined properly. This is, you know, we're in a battle initially here to get people to understand what militia means in its proper context within the constitutional framework. In other words, militia is not a bunch of adult Boy Scouts playing Army in the Woods in camouflage. It's not just a group of people who decide they're going to get together and in some sense be a force to protect their communities without any authority. It is a governmental authority in the states. And we've got to get people to – and regulate it, meaning that it is actually conformed – it is following conformed laws that have been written specifically to order, structure, maintain, train, and prepare those people for whatever the emergencies are that they would have to participate in. We've got to help people understand what the true definition is as our first action, and that's what we're trying to do in getting onto your show and other shows that we'll be talking about this and helping people to get the materials, reading it, listening to the DVDs or other audio materials that are available. We've got to help people understand the true definition. And then from there, once people get that definition clear, then they'll know what they need to do to help see that this get reenacted. In the state of Florida, we have a wonderful little provision in our Constitution. It's Article 8. It says that we have the right to instruct our representatives. And by the way, that's not just your legislator. That's also your governor and your sheriff. We have, because they're all our representatives, and we have the right to instruct them. But before we can go instruct them, we better make sure we know what we have to instruct them to do and what we want to instruct them to know. You know what I'm saying? So the very first step here is re-education. That's why we keep coming back to it. And then another piece of that is getting organized in that re-education to do what needs to be done. And that's what revitalizing the Second Amendment is all about.
Yeah, well, it's great work that you guys are doing. It's very vital because if you love liberty and you love the Constitution and you desire security, then the only way you can have security is if you step up to the duty of citizenship and understand what your rights and what your obligations are. Teach others, especially that rare breed of individual that we elect to office where it is seems to be that incompetency is the chief qualification. We are in the last 15 minutes of the show, so what I would like to do, if you don't mind, is kind of bring it home with a powerful summary. And why we haven't heard from Richard for a while, so I would like to hear any of his thoughts on what we've been talking about and any final points that he'd like to make, and then you, David, and then Tex and I will close it down.
Okay.
Well, my final comment would be that, indeed, the problem that we have is the problem caused by we the people, and it's time that we stand up and admit that that's what is the problem and do what we need to do to get it straightened out, primarily to educate ourselves and get ourselves motivated so that we can properly instruct our representatives and get back control of this government and get a return to constitutional governance. That's really what we need to do.
Very good, Richard. I would like to follow up by and summarize by saying this. I'm an educator. I've taught public school math and science for several years. I'm certified in two states as a teacher. And one of my biggest concerns at the moment is that the young people are not getting this idea that we're talking about tonight. And if our young people don't figure out how to grasp onto this, we're going to be in a boatload of hurt. In fact, I think that, again, I quoted George Washington earlier, but I'd like to ask you guys a question. Do you know what George Washington said was the most important science to teach our children?
The most important science?
Yes.
Well, he was a moonshiner, so I'm guessing, you know, cooking whiskey.
You're close. You're close. I'm going to read something to you. This is a quote by George Washington. Our primary object should be the education of our youth in the science of government. In a republic, what species of knowledge can be equally important and what duty more pressing than communicating it to those who are to be the future guardians of the liberties of the country? And that, so I'd like to kind of leave it there in terms of, you know, what we've talked about this last 2 hours. We've got to re-educate ourselves in the science of government, not only so we know it, but so that we can teach it to our children, because we're certainly not getting it in the public school systems or even the private school systems of this country. Had you even heard of the term science of government before? I hadn't heard of it until I read it from Washington. And
well, we call it political science these days, and it means something completely different.
Yeah, it does. I mean, he was talking about that we would be fully engulfed in an understanding of what our duties and our rights are within a constitutional framework. I really think that's where he was going. And by the way, I know that in his mind he was including that in that the militia of the several states, because – that was a burden of his heart. By the way, he thought that we should have a model just like Switzerland has. In that paper I told you about in 1790, he actually states, look at Switzerland and use them as a model. And, you know, Switzerland's never stopped. I've lived in Switzerland. I lived there for a year of my life. And I'm telling you, it's a wonderful model. They have the exact same concept that we have of each state actually controls the militia. They provide an automatic weapon to virtually the men of the entire country through the cantons, which are the states there, and they train regularly in the use of those weapons, and they train regularly. They have to give 300 days of service to the army of the state in every single canton in the state of country of Switzerland. And that was the model that Washington wanted to use. So I know that that was part of where he was going when he said to teach our children the science of government, because he ends that statement by saying that it's the communicating to those who are to be the future guardians of the liberties of this country. And he would have pointed to the militia as the way that you guard the liberty. So, you know, to me, that's that says it all. That's what we need to try to begin doing in this first phase of where we're going as a organization and how we're trying to get people organized in this country for our common good.
Excellent. Well, we appreciate all of you coming on, and we appreciate the conversation, and we'd like everybody to go and check out your website. You want to shout that out one more time, even though I have posted it on our show page, but go ahead and shout it out again so people can see it.
RT2A.org, or you can go to facebook.com/RT2A.org. I was kind of shouting it, but I hope that that gets the point across.
I think it does, and thank you very much. And, you know, whenever you guys have new initiatives, new programs, or anything else that you'd like to share, please let us know. I'm sure our audience is very interested, and we encourage everybody to check out the website and educate yourself. That's the most important thing. Thanks, gentlemen, for being on with us today.
Thank you for inviting us, and we look forward to seeing you again sometime.
All right, take care, guys. Thanks.
Thanks a lot.
All right, Tex, we're in the last 10 minutes, so why don't you go ahead and give us you know, your thoughts and put a little pretty bow on this, and then we'll bring it home.
Okay, well, I think what, you know, here we are in the latter days of America, and essentially we have forgotten everything that was given to us by the Founding Fathers. A lot of that is a problem of our education system, and particularly our public education system, which not only isn't teaching these things, but seemingly has no interest in passing these things on.
and perhaps perverting these things. But we can get them back. We can teach these ideas and these principles. They're enshrined in a document that's eminently readable that you can share with people as to what went into the thinking behind these concepts. Why are these amendments the amendments? Why? What is the purpose of this sentence? Why did they put this in here? The brakes on power. And as you've seen, looking at this, we're the longest standing republic or popular form of government in the history of mankind. We've lasted longer than the Greeks, longer than the Romans, longer than anybody else. And so there's something about this document, something about the way that they were thinking about power, how it's used and how it's abused by the state that kept us going this long. And people have all of a sudden, and I always find this interesting, all of a sudden come upon this thought that, oh, my God, we've lost it. You know, we're in the latter days. Things are going away. Whereas, you know, you think about, I mean, just 10, 15 years ago, we're in the 90s. And the Soviet Union was gone, and we were doing great, and America was the next big thing, and everything was going hunky-dory and everything. So a lot of this comes down to economics, how people feel about their own economic security, but really it doesn't. That comes down to how you look at your own outlook and how you look at your own life and what you think the prospects are. But realistically, there is always a power equation between you and the state. And the more that the power is localized towards you, the better off you're going to be, because the more control you're going to feel over your own life. And you won't feel this sense of, oh, my God, I'm not in control. So we need to get back to that. All of this is written into the Constitution. Start voting for people who talk about these things, right? Whether it is on the right or the left, start voting for the people who talk about these things, because the reality is there's a false left-right paradigm, and there is no left or right. The left or right, the two parties basically are coming together to form a duopoly, a new sort of super party, and what you need to find are the people who are speaking to the ideas and the concepts that you care about, and start voting for those at the local election level, because it's very difficult to change things at the national level now. But if you start changing things at the local level, that will percolate up to the national level. So do that, and you can start affecting the change, and talk about these things, have debates about these concepts. There are things that you think you know that perhaps you don't know. There are things that you don't know at all that other people have that you can learn from. So start having these conversations, because that's part of being an informed citizenry. We need to reengage in the conversation over the Constitution, what our rights are, what is the duty of government, what are the rights of government, what are the rights of the citizens, and have these conversations with your fellow citizens, because if your fellow citizens have a different concept of the rights of the citizens than you do, then A, you need to educate them as to what those rights actually are, or B, understand what they think that they are, so that you can start looking into why do they think that? How do we change this conversation back to what it's supposed to be? It took about 100 years of socialism to get the American people away from the concept of freedom and liberty and the sovereign citizen and sovereign state, and get them to the concept of the federal government knows everything, and we can't possibly do anything on our own, and my neighbors are a bunch of stupid boobs, but all these faceless bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. are somehow the anointed ones, and they know everything, and they always act in the best interest of the country. Start having that conversation, and you can start changing the dialogue in this country. So back to you, Rex.
Oh, nice shooting, Tex.
All right, well said, Tex.
Thank you, Jessup.
The fact is that nature abhors a vacuum. Spinoza said it, and he's right. And security is necessary for civilized society, security from foreign invasion, security from criminals, security from insurrections, and security from man-made and natural disasters that occur. Life is risk, okay? You can't avoid risk. Walking out of your front door is a risk. You are facing disease, you are facing car accidents, you are facing robbery, you're facing debased currency, you're facing natural disasters, the weather, and everything else. You cannot avoid risk. But risk can be managed. And the whole point of managing risk in the security sense is to have an ordered
society, and that requires participation. On the one extreme, you have the absolute individualism where a man is an island, but then, you know, you're left in the state of Robinson Crusoe or a caveman. In civilized society, we specialize
Absolutely.
And we benefit each other, exactly, by, yeah, talking to a volleyball. But we specialize and we trade our labor and our services in order to benefit each other. To do this, you also have to have freedom, and to have freedom to act in this manner through free markets, free association, religious freedom, the freedom to form families and communities, you have to have a security structure. That security structure comes in one of two ways, either by the local strongman who can muster up the forces and take over, or by a tyrannical diktat of a police state. Neither option works. One is basically a situation where you are, it's survival of the fittest, and it's a Hobbesian war of all against war, all. And the other one is a police state in which the risk really isn't gone. It just happens to be monopolized and consolidated by the state, and you are nothing more than a serf. So if you want liberty, and this isn't, as Tex said, this is not a left-right thing. Everybody wants liberty. We just have various preconceived notions about, you know, how to go about it, and that's what political discourse is for. But what is not up for debate is that we want to be free, and there is a duty and a price to pay for that freedom, and that is service in the benefit of your fellow man by having a structured system to respond to emergencies and risks. And that's precisely what the militias are about. This is not about a bunch of, you know, guys with, you know, chewing tobacco and deer rifles running around in the woods, you know, hunting things down. This is not about a militarized National Guard that locks down every city every time there's any kind of perceived manufactured or real threat. This is about a well-organized militia that has the authority of the sovereigns of this country, which are the individual citizens, working in concert through the organization of state and local governments. And until you restore that power, all of the other things that we are doing politically will eventually lead nowhere, because until you have ultimate recourse to force, that doesn't mean you have to use it, but you have to have recourse to it, whoever has the power wins. Now, you have to think of it this way. Why is the federal government buying millions of rounds of hollow point bullets and trying to pass laws to restrict how many rounds individual citizens can have? It's because it wants to fill that vacuum of power. And why are there people who are joining private militias? Because they want to resist that power. Neither option is beneficial. They are both chaotic extremes. The balance was where the founding fathers put it. And not only in principle and philosophy is this right, but it is also the law. And if we are a republic, that means we respect the law. And the law demands that each state have a militia. You have to educate yourself. You have to understand what this means. You have to stop being afraid of the word militia because it's not politically correct and because it's not taught. And it is up to you to educate yourself, teach others, especially the elected critters, so that we can actually undo the illicit codes that have thwarted what is the law according to the Constitution. And once we do this, then we will be in a position to provide for our own security at a local level with diffused power, and we also have the structure for a national defense if necessary under the commander-in-chief, who would be the president. So it's not that we have to figure out how to do these things. It's already spelled out for us. We just have to take back that power that we've been given and accept the responsibility that comes with liberty. So educate yourself, learn how this works, and it'll help us fix not only our collapsing monetary system, it'll help us ferret out corruption in government, it'll also help us correct our voting and ballot access process so that every individual has more of a say in government. With liberty comes responsibility. Don't shirk the responsibility. Don't be afraid of risk. You're a sovereign American. This is your country. You are the militia. Don't tread on me. This is Tex and Rex signing off.
The flames of liberty will never die.
Thank you.